do we do with lactate-guided therapy?
Sepsis is one of the most common things we see in the emergency department. How do we incorporate the results of the Andromeda shock trial into our clinical practice?
Trying to fix the hemodynamics may not always be a good thing. Can we use lactate-guided therapy to improve outcomes? There are some patients you just can't fix.
Yeah. Maybe we could do a better job. Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine. So happy to have a returning speaker here for this podcast, Dr. Rory Spiegel. Many of you know that we had Rory on just a few months ago to go over the Paramedic 2 trial, offer his insights in critical analysis in terms of epinephrine in cardiac arrest. Well, we're bringing Rory back because, well, disappointing for me, he's only got a few months left here at the University of Maryland. He will be heading south. I'll let him bring you up to speed on his imminent career plans. But as luck would have it, another big article was published in JAMA. EPUB ahead of print just a few months ago dealing with sepsis. And as also many of you know, Rory has authored some recent pieces on the Surviving Sepsis campaign along with SEP 3.0 and the potential one-hour bundle. I don't know that we'll get into a deep dive on that, but we're certainly going to talk about some sepsis resuscitation in lieu of the Andromeda shock trial. But first, Rory, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Thanks, Mike. It's always an honor. It's great to be here. And yes, I am kind of moving shops down the road a little bit to Washington Hospital Center, but I'm not too far away. So whenever you will have me on, I'd be honored to come on back.
We'll guarantee that for sure. Yeah, definitely when we get you on the podcast, lots of comments come in about when can we get more of Rory Spiegel, or as you're more affectionately known, EM Nerd, correct?
Yes, indeed.
Well, let's turn our attention to sepsis. As we've talked about in the past, and even when we're working together clinically in the ED, sepsis is one of the most common things we see in the emergency department in terms of critical illness. And as all of us are tasked with resuscitating the patient with sepsis or septic shock, there are also certain measures we take a look at in terms of getting appropriate antibiotics, administering perhaps the right amount of fluid, along with cultures, and then subsequently following signs of perfusion. And we predominantly do that today by measuring serial lactates, but not all of us work in resource settings where we do have access to lactate. And for that matter, we also know that there are many etiologies of hyperlactemia. And with that, I'd like to really get into discussing the Andromeda shock trial. Have you take us through the trial? What were the take-home messages, the limitations, and then really ultimately, how do we incorporate the results of the Andromeda shock trial into our clinical practice? So take it away.
Okay. Great. Well, I think to start, we just do a slight background on lactate and how we use it in sepsis right now. One, I think a lot of us thought or did find that it was beneficial, and we've also been mandated to draw a lactate and then a repeat lactate if it's high. And there's a number of assumptions that go with that kind of treatment. And the first one is, where is this lactate coming from in sepsis? And the original thought when we started using lactates in sepsis that this is a sign of end organ hypoperfusion. And it's essentially anaerobic metabolism. And then the next thought was, well, if we can correct that end organ hypoperfusion through hemodynamic measures, i.e. giving fluid boluses, vasopressors, and inotropes, we could then correct the lactate. And the final assumption is that if we use a lactate to guide our therapy, so we change or adapt our therapy for this lactate, we're going to improve patient outcomes. Now, it's really interesting. We've actually had some signals of data prior to this that maybe none of those things are actually true. The most interesting is it's actually become quite clear that most of the lactate we see in early sepsis has nothing to do with anaerobic metabolism, and most of it is a sympathetic response to the illness itself. So yes, lactate indicates a severity of illness. The higher your lactate is, typically the sicker you are, but it doesn't actually mean you have end organ hypoperfusion.
I think that's probably one of the big important pearls. Yeah. To start off here.
Exactly. And so the next one is actually really interesting. We've known for a long time that probably trying to fix the hemodynamics may not always be a good thing. And it goes back as far as Schumacher's original paper, which was published in the New England Journals in the 90s, where he actually tried to super correct your hemodynamic variables, to super correct your MAP, your tissue perfusion, and so forth. And he found an increased mortality. And that subgroup of septic patients. And there's other signals. I mean, if you look at the FEAST trial and the Andrews trial, both are studies done in sub-Saharan Africa, one on children and one on adults with sepsis, but they found giving fluid boluses versus either no fluid or a slow fluid infusion increased mortality. And we have a few other studies showing that aggressive hemodynamic resuscitation may actually not be optimal in sepsis. And I think the final thing is, can we use lactate-guided therapy to improve outcomes? Now, if you take the first two, you could probably already conclude no, since lactate isn't actually a signal of tissue hypoperfusion, and trying to correct hypoperfusion may not be beneficial, then using lactate to correct hypoperfusion doesn't quite make sense. But what we did know is, if you look at observational data, that patients with elevated lactate, if they cleared their lactate, they did better. Mm-hmm. Now, you could say that's because we improved them by giving them whatever treatments we did, or we simply got source control. The stress of their infection improved and their lactate cleared itself. Mm-hmm. So we didn't really know which one was the case. And this trial can kind of start giving us some insight into that. So that kind of gives us a background.
Background.
Good. So now that we're all on the same page, we can kind of talk about the trial. And it was the Andromeda Shock Trial, published in JAMA a few months ago. Really interesting study. And the methodology is a little bit complex, so I'm going to try to run through it and simplify it. But essentially, they randomized patients into one of two resuscitation strategies. And the first resuscitation strategy was a peripheral perfusion-based strategy, which essentially is they tried to correct capillary refill. So mm-hmm. the patient had an abnormal capillary refill. They did a few different techniques or procedures to try to correct that, and we'll run through those in a sec. The other group was a lactate-guided approach, where they tried to correct an elevated lactate. And that was really the only thing that differed between the two groups, was what they were using to guide their therapy with.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but they did have a standard approach to monitoring capillary refill time,
yes,
where they would use, I think, the distal pad of the maybe right index finger,
yeah,
and
they used
blanch
like a
it.
Slide, yeah, yeah, and they had a timer. It was something that we would never actually do. Yeah. It also required a 30-minute check, so you know, it was very resource-intense, yeah, version of a peripheral perfusion approach.
So in the capillary refill time, or the peripheral perfusion group, they were assessing capillary refill time every 30 minutes with the goal to normalize,
yes,
capillary refill time,
yeah,
right?
And the important part is they were actually checking it in both groups. So it's not like the patients in the cap refill curve just had people checking on them more often. It,
okay,
was checked in both groups, but it was only used to guide resuscitation in the capillary refill.
Got it.
So those are basically the only things that differ between the two groups. Now, the question is, how did they correct either capillary refill or elevated lactate? And that was their resuscitation protocol. And so the only thing that really differed is how you entered into that protocol. Once you were in it, it was treated the same way. And it started with, we'll use the lactate group as an example. If you had an elevated lactate, you were then assessed to see if you were fluid responsive or not. Before we get there, I think maybe let's just talk about who these patients were, because it was actually quite a sick group of patients. So to get into the trial, you have to have a known or suspected infection, be hypotensive after a 20 cc per kg fluid bolus, be on vasopressors to maintain a MAP over 65, and have a lactate greater than 2. So if you look at that subset of septic patients, the mortality is pretty high in there,
right,
30 to 40%. You'll see that's kind of what this comes out with in the end. But mm-hmm. So it's quite a sick group of patients. So once they were randomized to either peripheral perfusion or a lactate approach, they were put into this resuscitation pathway. And if either one was abnormal, the clinician was then asked to assess for fluid responsiveness. And they could assess for fluid responsiveness in a number of ways. The most common was either pulse pressure variation, mm-hmm, or using some ultrasound techniques, a VTI variation or so forth. There was some passive leg raise and so forth. But all the ways were definitely validated to some degree that you were going to assess for fluid responsiveness. If the patient was determined to be fluid responsive, they got a 500 cc fluid bolus, after which the capillary refill time or the lactate was rechecked to see if it fixed the problem.
Mm-hmm.
If it didn't fix the problem, they were again assessed for fluid responsiveness. And that cycle was repeated until one of two things happened. Either you fixed the capillary refill time or the lactate cleared,
mm-hmm,
or they were deemed no longer to be fluid responsive.
Okay. So that was step one.
That was step one.
Got it.
So if you ended up clearing the lactate or fixing the capillary refill time, they were bumped out of the pathway and you kind of deem them to be resuscitated.
Got it.
If, on the other hand, they were found to no longer be fluid responsive, but they still had one of the two abnormalities in tissue malperfusion, they went to the next step. And this was to look at the patients and see if they have a history of hypertension before they were sick. And the thought here is that these patients' organs are used to a higher mean arterial pressure, and so a MAP of 65 may not be adequate for them. You might be hyperperfusing that subset of patients' organs.
Okay.
And so in this case, they did a MAP push. They basically increased your MAP to 75 to 85 to see if this improved either the lactate clearance or the capillary refill
time. Got it.
Right. And so if it improved capillary refill time or lactate clearance again, you were out of the pathway, deemed resuscitated, and you moved on from there.
And did they keep those people at the higher MAP?
For, I think, 24 hours was the goal. Yes. And then what happened next is if this still didn't fix the problem with end organ malperfusion, they moved on to an inotropic challenge. So they started an inotropic dobutamine or inotropic dose epinephrine to see if that then fixed either the lactate clearance or the capillary refill times. And that was essentially their whole pathway. They don't really actually get into what happens if none of those things fix the problem, which, as you find in a group of sick patients, there are some patients you just can't fix any of those things. So that part wasn't really clear, but this is essentially the pathway. It was exactly the same in each group. The only thing that changed was how you got into it and how you got out of it. So what they were guiding to deem tissue hypoperfusion.
Okay.
Makes sense so far?
Makes sense. So step one, step two, step three. Are we ready to talk about what their primary outcome were or get to the results?
So overall, they enrolled 424 patients. It was a multi-center study. It was a pretty big study, and the majority of these patients, 71%, were enrolled in the emergency department. So this has a lot of validity for what we do every day.
Agreed.
And what they actually found, their primary outcome is 28-day mortality, which is a pretty reasonable and common outcome in sepsis trial. And they found something that's fairly interesting. There was actually no statistical difference between the two groups in 28-day mortality. But if you actually look at the point estimate, it was 34.9 in the capillary refill time and 43.4 in the lactate-guided group. Now, that's an 8.5% absolute difference.
Which is fairly significant.
Yeah, and it just missed statistical significance of the p-value of 0.06. Mm-hmm. And so when you kind of go and look, they powered this study to find a 15% absolute difference in mortality, which there's not many things in medicine that produces 15% absolute difference in mortality. So one could argue that this study might be underpowered to detect this difference.
Okay.
So that's kind of the take-home message, and now we can get into what do we do with these results, because I think this is fascinating and it's really interesting, and you can interpret this in a number of ways. If you're a true frequentist statistics, if you believe in frequentist statistics, you could say, well, there's no difference between these two ways. You can use capillary refill time or lactate, they're equivalent. But you could also say, well, it certainly looks like a lactate-guided approach is close to being harmful. And if you look at these confidence intervals, yes, you can't rule out that this was because of statistical chance, but it's pretty close to being so. Mm-hmm. And that is concerning. Or you could kind of say something even further, and you could say, well, maybe neither of these ways is actually the best way of resuscitating a patient. Maybe the only reason the lactate-guided approach did worse is because they were more likely to got put into this pathway of aggressive resuscitation. Mm-hmm. So you were more likely to have people with elevated lactates who then didn't clear and continued to get fluid boluses and pressors and inotropes. And if you look at the data, the lactate group got more fluid, more pressor therapy, more pressure pushes, and more inotropic therapy. So we essentially did more things to them. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's simply that's the only reason the lactate group did worse than the capillary refill time group, is just because we ended up doing more things. And if you had an approach that just did less, in fact, didn't put them in this pathway at all, maybe they would have done even better.
Now, just to clarify that on the fluids, my recollection is that fluid amount difference was probably about a half a liter, maybe a little less.
Yeah, so the median amount of fluids was about a half a liter difference, which isn't that much in the big picture, but clearly they were being pushed towards to no longer be fluid responsive more often than the other group. There's many of us now that believe in EM and critical care. We all walk around being fluid responsive. Mm-hmm. And there's no one that is healthy that you'd put the ultrasound probe on and find the fact that they're not fluid responsive, right? And so driving someone to the flat portion of their Starling curve is by definition iatrogenic fluid overload. Mm-hmm. And so to seek and destroy fluid responsiveness is likely not doing your patient any favors.
I like that comment.
So, I mean, that's essentially the summary of it. The take-home point is really interesting. I think with this data, what do we do with lactate-guided therapy? There's nothing evil about a lactate. It's a lab test. There are some lab tests that are evil. The lactate is not one of them. I guess it's more of a question of what do we do with it? And I think, you know, there's like a Pavlovian reflex to see an elevated lactate and give fluid. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be in sepsis. It can be in anything. There's many times when I'm working in the emergency department and we have a patient who had a seizure and someone drew a lactate and it's 12. And, you know, you walk by the room and they're in there texting on their phone and the resident wants to give them some fluid to clear that lactate. And you explain that most lactate is cleared by the liver. This patient obviously wasn't fluid down before. There's no signs of end organ malperfusion here. Mm-hmm. We don't need to give them fluid. I think one of the more clinically relevant examples is a post-cardiac arrest patient. Mm-hmm. Got Rusk in the field, coming to you. So they were dead for a little while. This was true end organ malperfusion.
Correct.
But now they have their heart back. It wasn't because they were fluid down. It's because their heart wasn't working. And so just reflectively bolusing them a large amount of fluids might not do them any favors. In fact, they might have cardiac dysfunction at this point. We're going to cause venous congestion and fluid overload and lead to worse outcomes if we just reflexively respond to a lactate mm-hmm. with fluid. And I think this is the very same thing you see here and with sepsis in general. If you go back to the Andrews trial, which we talked about, which was that JAMA trial that looked at adult patients in sub-Saharan Africa treated for sepsis. They were randomized in two groups. One was a goal-directed approach, mm-hmm. and one was, let's not give them much fluid at all. They put them on a slow infusion and just kind of let it go over a liter or so. The goal-directed approach improved their lactates much faster. Their blood pressure corrected much better. They just died more frequently, mm-hmm. right? So maybe if we just reflexively respond to elevated lactates with giving more fluid or walking them down these pathways, patients will do worse. I think there is an advantage of lactates. I tend to use them if my lactate isn't clearing the way I think it should. It kind of signals to me that maybe I don't have source control. Maybe I should be looking for an intra-abdominal process, mm-hmm. you know, go back and examine the patient, roll them to see if they've got neck fascia in their groin, so mm-hmm. on and so forth. So it always makes me think, do they have a line in? And that's the source of my infection. But it kind of cues me in as maybe I don't have source control the way I would like. Mm-hmm.
That's a great pro. And, you know, I think one thing coming out of this particular study, reading it, and I don't know if your experience has been different, but certainly over the past 10 or 15 years, I think the degree to which we really actually do undress and truly assess the patient, and even look at capillary refill for that matter, yeah. is not that often.
No.
And maybe we could do a better job, perhaps even combining or using the lactate in addition to being a little bit better, paying closer attention to peripheral perfusion.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what they ended up comparing here was a group that was truly looking at peripheral perfusion versus a group that was looking at a marker that mostly is the sympathetic stress of the infection itself. And you have to question whether using that kind of marker to fix peripheral perfusion is really beneficial.
Well, Rory, this has been enormously helpful. This is a big article, I think, you know, especially yeah. from 2019 as we get started here early in the year. Certainly something that has been talked about, will continue to be talked about. Any final thoughts before we close out our podcast?
Yeah, I think the last thing is it'll be really interesting to see what CMS and the Surviving Sepsis Campaign do with this data. Because right now, at least if you're in practicing in the U.S., you have a mandate to draw lactate and draw a second lactate if it's elevated. And certainly now we have data that at the best, it's not helpful. It's just logistically cumbersome, and it's one of the major reasons we fail our CMS bundle in the U.S., and at worst, it can be harmful. So I think it'll be interesting to see where they go with this data and if they use this to get rid of the two-hour lactate mandate.
Well, to that end, I mentioned it as we started the podcast, but we don't have time to, it actually probably would take an entire podcast, maybe a series of podcasts to debate the 1 hour bundle, you've got some great point counterpoint discussions, I think, in CHEST,
yep.
along with an article in Annals of Emergency Medicine yeah. about the dangers of adopting this 1 hour bundle. So yeah. congrats on those publications.
Thank you. Well done.
And I defer all of our listeners to those publications, and you do a really great job outlining a whole lot of things and controversies with the 1 hour sepsis bundle.
Yeah, it was a whole group of us, Josh Farkas, Scott Weingart, and a bunch of others. Paul Marrick was on the team, and so it got us all riled up, and I'm glad we were able to put something out there.
Well, if any of you out there have questions for Rory, questions about the Andromeda shock trial, please be sure to shoot us a note through the website. Hopefully you are all enjoying the updated CCPEM website. Gotten many emails about the increased or improved listener experience and how easy it is now to listen to the podcast. So our thanks for those comments. Any suggestions, keep them coming. We love to hear them and then see what we can do to incorporate them in upcoming editions of our website. So for now, I'm going to go ahead and sign off for this podcast. We're just at about our 20-minute mark. My thanks to Rory Spiegel for coming on and talking about this landmark trial for 2019. And my congrats, Rory, for coming to the end and closing out fellowship. And really couldn't wish you the best of luck in heading down to Washington Hospital Center. And I'm going to look forward to seeing you throughout the coming year, whether it be podcasts, whether it be at conferences, or just chatting.
Well, thanks, Mike. It's always an honor to be here. You know, Maryland will have a very special place in my heart, as I did both of my fellowships here and some time as an attending. So,
well, we hope so, for sure.
Thankfully, I'm not too far away, so I'd love to come back.
All right. This is Mike Winters once again for Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Look forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.